You want kicking things out of orbit?
Oh my gosh!
I'm gonna just knock it sideways.
One of the greatest fighters.
John Jones beat every champion. Pretty much now.
Khabib gets his hands on McGregor, it's gonna be that night.
Let's get into it.
It's been a long time. We shouldn't have left you without a dope beat to step two. Step two. Hello, you are listening to the Fight Night Picks Recap Show. I'm John Franklin. This week on the show, we discuss all the fights from UFC 61. UFC 261, Usman versus Masvidal 2. I will do all of this with one half of the Fight Night Picks preview show. Speaking, of course, of the great Matt Allen. Matt, how are you?
I'm great. What a night of fights that we just had. I'm excited to recap it all because we have an awful lot to talk to. Or talk about. Goodness. I'm so excited. I'm missing my words already.
We're both a mess. Matt, we'll pull it together. All right, Matt. One thing I've always been fascinated with is this theory of better angels, of our personalities. It's who we are at our best. The better angels tell us that we are in the midst of a global pandemic, and there maybe should not be a venue full of people unmasked in Jacksonville, Florida. But I'm going to give you full moral and social immunity here and give you full cover to answer this question, which is, how did you feel just watching a UFC event again with a full crowd?
It was weird. It was, and it did take kind of a fight to get used to, sort of. And I say that, but also on the other hand, it didn't take that long for me to get annoyed with the boos and the woos, because the woos got to go. I don't care. The UFC just has to make sure, like, hey, if you're going to buy a ticket, there's a no woo policy here. Like, no woos allowed. If we catch you wooing, we're kicking you out immediately, because that got old quick. But other than that, I really enjoyed it. I do think the crowd and just the atmosphere in general adds a lot to MMA. And this is the other great thing about having a crowd. Like, all the videos that you see, like crowd reactions from last night, like that's the stuff that you're going to talk about into next week and whatnot. Like, all those videos that people had from their own phones taking it of Usman knocking out Masvidal, like hearing that noise from inside the crowd, it made it feel like it was a real UFC event again. And the fact that we did have three title fights on it just really made the whole night a really special night. But personally, I felt like it did add quite a bit to the whole experience. Although, yes, I will admit, I do feel like it is a little bit soon in this whole pandemic to be having 20,000 people in a closed air arena. But aside from that, no, I did think that it added a lot to the experience. I didn't like the whole F Jake Paul thing. MMA people got to stop giving him the time of day, because that's the problem. If you're going to become a bigger issue, because people like us are going to keep on talking about him. But that was a little bit too much. But no, I really did enjoy the crowd.
You know, absence makes the heart grow fonder. And I think that's kind of what we're experiencing a little bit of last night. All right, let's get to the fights. Matt, Kamaru Usman said before their first fight that Jorge Masvidal took the fight on short notice, not because he thought he could win, but because doing so would give him a built-in excuse when he lost. It turns out Usman was right, as Masvidal parlayed that loss into last night's fight, a rematch for the belt. But in keeping with the theme of Kamaru Usman speaking truth into existence, he also said that it would be worse for Masvidal this time around, and boy, was it ever. The result reads, Kamaru Usman defeats Jorge Masvidal via TKO, 102 of round number 2, but that really doesn't tell the whole story, as Usman controlled pace, level, distance, and timing, and put Jorge Masvidal on the highlight reel, knocking him dead. Matt, that's what I saw. What'd you see?
I saw just a wild, wild main event, because that was the thing. And going into this fight, we all knew, like, Jorge Masvidal loses fights, but when he loses fights, it's always a split decision or a close fight. He never really does get beat soundly. And when he does get beat soundly, I hate to say he can use grappling as an excuse, but to the more wider audience, maybe the more casual fan, you can kind of use that as an excuse. Like, hey, if he didn't hold me, I probably would have beat him. The old Nate Diaz philosophy. I didn't lose the fight. I just ran out of time. But with Masvidal, this is one of the first times where he doesn't really have that excuse. Like, you had the full training camp. That was your excuse after the first fight. You had your full training camp, and Usman just looked better at the end of the day. Luke Thomas put out a tweet, and he said, I don't doubt at all that Jorge Masvidal has improved with a full training camp, but he hasn't improved nearly as much as Usman did with three training camps with Trevor Whitman. And I really like what Usman did. I don't think we see this enough really in championship tier MMA, but sometimes one guy can get you to a title, but you really need to go to another gym to just learn more skills. Like, you can only get so much juice out of the squeeze at a certain point. I just feel like Henry Hooft had gotten Kamaru Usman to the highest point that he could at that gym. You can only train with the same guy so many times before, really, you just learn all you can from the same group of people. I think him going to Trevor Whitman, and really still cross-training at Sanford MMA, it's not like that's some burn bridge like we've seen from, you know, when TJ Dillashaw left Team Alpha Male, for instance. Like, right when he left, they basically said, you're no longer welcome in these doors. But with Usman. He seems to be a really genuine guy. He said that he was talking back and forth with Henry Hooft leading up to this fight, asking for some advice. So I just think you really can't praise the fight IQ and just the motor, really, of Kamaru Usman. Like, it's very rare that you see a champion who continues to improve after they've kind of reached the peak. Most of the time, you become champion, you have a lot of exciting fights, you have to prove your worth, then you get the belt, and you start fighting in a more safe manner because you don't want to lose that belt. Is Kamaru Usman the first champion in UFC history who's gotten not just a little bit more exciting, but way more exciting after capturing the title? Like, he's going out there and really putting hands on guys now. And yes, the first Masvidal fight wasn't all that exciting, but listen, on short notice, weird things happen. Habib probably should have beat Ally Quinta a lot more handily than he did, but that was only on one day's notice, and things happen on short notice. Fights can be close, and they can be boring, but what Usman has proved in his last two fights, in the burn stoppage and in this finish, is like, he's kind of turning into that bulletproof mixed martial artist. Like, if you want to beat Kamaru Usman, you're going to have to show us something that we've probably never seen before in the welterweight division, and I know we always look back and compare, oh, is Kamaru Usman as good as GSP? And no, he's not. And I know I'm Canadian and I'm probably way too biased about this, but no, Kamaru Usman hasn't reached that goal yet. But he's the best welterweight champion since GSP. Like, it's no longer, is he as good as Woodley? Kamaru Usman's way better than Tyron Woodley. And not that we just saw them fight, but just look at his past few performances. You see not only the ability to finish, but his just ability to dominate his opponent is unlike any other champion in the UFC. So for Kamaru Usman, that was one of the most impressive performances of his career. I really think so. And with him being so boring, I guess, for lack of a better term, in that first fight, I had a lot of friends who aren't really hardcore MMA fans just be like, I'm not that interested in this fight. If Usman wins, he's just going to foot stomp him 200 times and we'll see what happens. But I'm pretty sure all those people didn't end up tuning in because they all just kept on blowing up my phone right after a fight companion. So all in all, just a wild main event for that welterweight title.
You know, it was, and you gave me a lot to unpack there, so let's unpack it. I think that when we're talking about Kamaru Usman, let's start with the Trevor Whitman of it all. And, you know, I don't know what they call this in Canada, but here's what they call it in the States. Trevor Whitman's grad school, right? Like, he got his bachelor's with Henry Hooft, and now he's getting his master's degree with Trevor Whitman, and at some point, you know, maybe on his own, he'll go get his doctorate. And he's just becoming this mixed martial artist that has a lot of skills. And he's like, you know, fine tuning and polishing all those skills. As far as who he is, you know, there's two schools of thought when you're a champion, right? There's the Ronda Rousey, Khabib Nurmagomedov approach, which is I have something no one else has. And I'm going to make them deal with the thing that I have that they don't and that they can't seem to stop, which Ronda did it with her grappling and her submission arm bars. Khabib did it with his wrestling. And then there's the John Jones approach, which is each time out, I'm evolving as a mixed martial artist and I'm going to give you something new to look at. If you're watching video of me, it does you no good because each time I'm going to come out as a different guy. And we talked about this, I think after the first Masvidal fight, we may have talked about it after the Burns fight, but Kamaru Usman can win fights a lot of ways. And we're starting to see that about him now. You know, he's using his, which a lot of guys have done. Typically what happens with wrestlers is they, like Johnny Hendricks, right? They fall in love with their hands. They use the fact that you can't take them down as a way to keep the fight standing. I don't see that with Usman. I see him putting himself in real harm's way. And like he's learning, you know, it's on-the-job training. He's learning as he goes. He's getting cracked here and there. Sometimes his punches aren't as clean as they should be. I mean, you know, Masvidal found some pot shots here and there, some quick strikes. But I think that Usman, much like Israel Adesanya, is and listen, if we want to get really into the Nigerians here, Francis Ngannou as well. These guys are showing a high aptitude and a high ability to take what they're learning in the cage, work on it outside the cage, and come back as more evolved fighters. All three of them are. And I mean, that seems to be, other than Nigeria, the connective tissue with all of them. And I think that that's going to make for an interesting, time moving forward because they're all really in their prime.
And you summed it up perfectly. Like, that's the perfect thing. Like, you look at MMA, and by definition, you think of MMA as, oh, the biggest and the strongest guy is going to win. And yeah, they sometimes do. But like you had said, yes, Francis is big and strong. Yes, Usman's big. And yes, Israel is for their weight class. But just their ability to not be stuck in their ways, like some of those former guys that you brought up were. Like, yeah, Johnny Hendricks was a great wrestler. But the problem was he fell in love with his power and forgot about the technique behind his striking. Whereas Usman, like, technically, he does have a really good jab. He can switch stances. He can do a lot of those kind of more niche things in the striking that you normally don't see at a wrestler. So, no, I think you broke that down perfectly. It's more about their just ability to learn and their willingness to absorb more information than it is just their physical, I guess, abilities and techniques inside the cage.
All right, Matt, so put your floaties on because I'm about to drown you in animal metaphors. Let's talk about the elephant in the room, which is what Jorge Masvidal is and what he's not. So if we keep it in the animal kingdom, Masvidal at best is probably like a snake. He waits for the right time to strike, and he's deadly when he does. But Kamaru Usman is the king of the jungle, right? He's a lion. He's equal parts speed and power, which brings us to Colby Covington, who you can make an argument is also a lion, right? He's going to go in there. He's going to try and impose his will. So listen, he's trying to promote a fight. Covington is. He's sort of clinging to any bit of success he had in their first fight, even though he lost the fight. The reality is that Usman's probably got his number, and he's improving at a very high rate, like we just said. Does Covington have a chance here? I mean, is there any chance that he's evolving, that he can get into the whole skullduggery of it and get Usman off his game? Or is Usman really hitting his stride now and all that stuff is just kind of – he's not falling for the kid games anymore?
So just because I'm a big Planet Earth fan, I'll even keep it in the animal kingdom. Colby Covington is the hyena in all this. Like, hyenas matched up one for one against the lion, they can't win. But in numbers, they can make it a fight. And with Covington, yes, it's not like there's other people in there fighting with him. But all those other hyenas in the background is all that noise. And all that noise isn't just the crowd. It's the social media. It's the buildup. It's everything he does that takes your focus off of what the fight should be about. But I agree with you. At this point, I just see the improvements that Usman's made between really his first fight against Covington and now. And you look, he still has that same power. He still has the cardio and the takedown defense, but now he has the more technique behind his strikes. He throws in combination now. And I think he's just a much smarter striker. I think if anyone out there has the style to give Usman trouble, it will be Covington, just because they do complement each other so well. They both have the cardio. They both have the volume. I just don't think Covington has that power X factor. And at the end of the day, if you have two guys who are going tit for tat like they were in the first fight, I just think that power is going to win out eventually. And with Usman, who's to say we don't see him level up and striking another tier and another tier? Like, every single time he goes out there with Trevor Whitman, they're getting another 6 months together. They're getting another 4 months together. Like, all that time and all those training camps are going to make more and more improvements for Usman. And the thing with Whitman too is he's like Mike Brown in this respect. They're not just about the X's and O's. They've got a great game plan too. And I understand Mike Brown was unfortunately on the losing end of last night's main event, but still, he's a guy who's known for getting his fighters very ready for game plans. And the great thing about Whitman is I think he'll get Usman ready for anything Covington can bring at him. And the thing about Covington is he just kind of gets better at the things he's already good at, fight in and fight out. Like, Colby Covington still does the same stuff now that he did way back when he beat Max Griffin at UFC 202. He's just gotten better at his wrestling and MMA. His cardio has just improved even more, and now his volume can match. So I actually am excited for that title fight. I do think that it will be a compelling matchup, and I think it'll be a competitive fight. I do. It's just at this point, I don't know who's going to beat Usman at welterweight.
So this is the point in the segment where we typically talk about, you know, who's calling, the coach, the matchmaker, or Dana. It should be Dana, but here's where I struggle with Usman, is that he checks every box that you would want him to check, but I just don't feel the it factor. And, you know, he's starting to do power, which means he's starting to finish guys in big ways. Last night was finishing Jorge Masvidal the way he did is a star-making performance, right? Like, it's more impressive to finish Jorge Masvidal the way he did last night than the way Jorge Masvidal finished Ben Askren. So by definition of what makes a star, he should be a star. Good dad. You got the Nigeria thing. You got the long win streak. You got the evolution. Now you got the power. Good looking guy. I just don't know that he's going to become a star. And I guess the question becomes, if you're Usman, should it matter? And is it something you should try to force, or do you just say, listen, I'm the greatest of all time, or I'm on that. I'm at least on that path now. He's on a path right now where he could catch GSP if he stays the course. So, what do you think?
No, I agree 100%. I think if anyone ever catches GSP at 170 pounds, it's going to be Kamaru Usman. And just stylistically, he fights kind of in the same way as GSP. Now, I understand they have different wrestling backgrounds, but they both are very wrestling dominant MMA fighters. But they were guys who used their wrestling and then they added other components into their game. So that's the really cool thing about Usman. I just don't really know what you do next with him, just star potential wise, because it's like you said, he does check a lot of those boxes, but the problem is he's not really on an extreme of anything. Like you say, he's a good dad. He does good in his community, but he doesn't do anything that's so extreme out to like a Justin Wren, for instance, that you could really market it. Like Kamaru Usman really is just kind of a regular guy who also happens to be this killer. And unfortunately, it's hard to market people like that in the world of MMA, which does suck. So for Usman, I do think at a certain point it's going to become where his skills are just undeniable. Because for me, I don't really understand why John Jones is a big star. I don't. I understand that he is one, but for me, I just assume people like watching John Jones because he is that. His skills are just at such a high level that they're undeniable at a certain point. I think Usman, if he is ever going to get to that million pay-per-view buys, where I know he did with Masvidal the first time around, but that was mainly because Masvidal was being brought into that. That would not have sold anywhere near that if it was just Usman. But if Usman himself is ever going to be the main draw on like around a million pay-per-view buy card, you're going to have to get, you know, like the three title fights, have a Max Holloway on there, have a Robert Whittaker. Like, you're really going to have to beat that up. So for Usman, I don't really think he cares, but I think there's a little star potential there for him. I really do. I think if he can go out there, if you can somehow build up that Covington fight as, hey, Covington was leading going into the fifth on one judge's scorecard. Another judge had it 2-2. Like, no one's ever had a close fight with Usman other than Covington in the UFC. So I think if you can market that up in a way, and then have Usman win that rematch in, you know, an equally impressive fashion, or if he could finish him like he did Masvidal even more violently, then I do think there's the potential there. I just don't ever think Usman's going to get into that top tier of pay-per-view sellers of the Adesanyas, the John Jones and whatnot. I think he's going to be more than just a regular champion. Like, Kamaru Usman's probably more famous than Stipe Miocic, but I never really see him breaking into that top tier, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's weird. You know, like you said, you never can tell what it takes for these guys to become stars. I mean, the only person I've seen, I take that back, there's been a couple, who was like a genuinely nice guy who didn't try to draw the whole "I'm watching to see you get beat" crowd was GSP. I mean, when he fought, his approval rating was pretty high. Not to say there weren't people that didn't tune in to see him get beat. Most of that was because of who he fought, right? Like, he fought Nick Diaz and he fought BJ Penn. These are guys with huge followings. So, of course, they're going to root, you know, people like Matt Hughes, they're going to root against GSP because they're a fan of his opponent. But there wasn't people that, like, you know, people would root against Floyd Mayweather or Conor, not even knowing who the opponent was. They're just like, I want to see Conor McGregor win. I want to see Floyd lose. I mean, I'm sorry, I want to see Conor McGregor lose or Floyd lose. So I don't want to see Kamaru Usman do the heel turn, but at the same time, I can't quite figure out how else he would get the type of the type of pay-per-view buys and become the type of star that he wants to be, if not for that.
All right, you, man, say heel turn, but it's kind of wild. Is MMA the only sport where Kamaru Usman's kind of considered a heel right now? Like, yeah. Colby Covington's low-key a bit of a baby face in their matchup. That's the wild thing. So for Usman, it would be kind of nice. He was just like, screw it. You don't like watching me fight? Like, I'm just going to go out there and finish your favorite fighter every single time. It would be kind of neat if he did play it that way. Like, hey, if you think anybody's close to me skill-wise, put them in there and please try to find someone to beat me. He doesn't have great mic skills. He has good mic skills. And I really do think that's the thing that keeps you out of that top tier. Because Izzy, yes, he's a fun fighter to watch. But the thing that people do like is he can sell a fight at the end of the day. And people like the things that he can say. With Usman, again, it's just nothing is ever that extreme. He can have a nice line here or there. But a lot of the things that Usman says and a lot of the highlights he gets press conference-wise are, he just says what fighters have said in the past and then just tries to reference them in the future. Like, even last night, he was like, oh, those last shots on Masvidal were super necessary. Like, I get it. It's a bit in the moment, and you can, you know, look at what Masvidal said against Askren. It's just, you need your own lines at a certain point, and people aren't really going to gravitate towards you unless you are going to be able to get your own creative lines and whatnot. Like, be like Michael Bisping. Just try to be funny. That should be every fighter's mentality.
Yeah, and I'm with you. I think that sometimes he thinks his gimmick is, I'm going to take what you said and shove it up your ass. And I think that doesn't really – it doesn't make you as popular as you'd want to be. All right. Matt, let's move on. Rose Namajunas is a fighter who's always had the respect of the MMA community, but at the same time, someone whose true greatness has never been fully appreciated. She came into Saturday 10-4 with just about as strong a streak of schedule as you're going to find. She has victories over former champs Joanna Jędrzejczyk, Jessica Andrade, and the loss to Andrade was a slam, which I don't want to take anything away from Andrade for doing it, but, you know, sometimes you get knocked out by a slam, sometimes you don't. For Wiley Zhang, she took the title in impressive fashion. She defended it in an absolute war. So coming into this fight, this was perhaps the best matchup you can make at the weight class. It seemed to be a fight of the night waiting to happen. That was, of course, until Thug Rose threw a left high kick and changed everything. Matt, the tough part in our business is not to ascribe too much credit to a fighter who got a knockout basically when someone zigged when they should have zagged, right? So last night, do you think that it was simply that Wiley Zhang zigged when she should have zagged? Or will she forever be a bad matchup? Or, I'm sorry, will Rose forever be a bad matchup for her? And this might be the beginning of a long Rose Namajunas title reign.
Okay, just because I love basketball so much. If I make a bunch of three-pointers and then I pump fake and you go flying by me, I'm eventually going to drive to the hoop. And that's kind of what we saw. I know the fight was only a minute long, but Weili thought she was going to be hit with a leg kick. She pulled her front leg back because she was anticipating a leg kick because Rose had kicked her in the leg right before that. She wasn't anticipating the high kick. So honestly, I just think Namajunas set that up in a very short amount of time. And I'd say I'm a bigger Rose critic than most just because I thought that if anything, she was more a product of just sort of the time. She fought Joanna when Joanna wasn't really at her peak. Mentally, she seemed off, knocked her out in the first round. Then she beat her in that crazy rematch. And honestly, I thought Joanna won their second fight. And this is going to be a theme because I thought Joanna beat Wei Li too. But anyways, besides all of that, what Rose did was really impressive. And she was kind of turning into that Randy Couture of the heavyweight division where it felt like every other Rose Namajunas fight was for the title. It's just like, okay, I get it. Rose Namajunas is another title eliminator or another title fight. But she really has shown that, again, I'm going to bring up Trevor Whitman again. Trevor Whitman is a master of not only game plans, but striking. And the way that she was able to feint the leg kick into the high kick was a beautiful shot. The question I am going to bring it back to you with, though, do you think Wei Li goes down with that shot if she doesn't go through the war with Joanna a year earlier? Because here's the thing. Getting hit with a head kick is going to put pretty much anybody down. That's the thing. But that wasn't even her back leg with a head kick. That was a lead leg head kick that did seem more like a flick than anything. And of course, listen, getting kicked in the head is a big shot. Don't get me wrong. But we've seen much bigger shots. We've seen fighters get hit by bigger shots and react to them much less. So I guess, do you think Wei Li goes down if she doesn't have that crazy fight with Joanna only last year?
That's a tough one because it does seem like I don't know enough about Wiley's career to know if the fight with Jędrzejczyk was like the fifth war she'd been in, the eighth war. If it's just – if we're saying that the only tough fight – the only wild night that she really had was with Jędrzejczyk, then I think no. The short answer to your question would be no. You can make – you know, it's funny. I told a story to my students the other day, which I'll bring this around, don't worry. But, you know, I've been in a couple of car accidents in my day, and the times that I'm in car accidents, I never get hurt. And the reason why I never get hurt is in the past, it's been a while since I've been in one, but I never, most of the time I'm at fault, or was. So I never gave up the fact, I never just let go of the fact that I was going to be in a car accident. I always had my hands on the wheel. I was always kind of being a part of it, right? And what happened that I told my kids the other day was, I flipped my truck once. I fell asleep at the wheel, overcorrected, and flipped my truck. But when I woke up, I had my hands on the wheel. I was trying to prevent it, and I think that's what kept me safe. The question I would have, and here's me bringing it back, is if you're right, and I think that you are, that she was thinking lower half of her body and got hit in the upper half of her body, it could have been something as simple as that where, you know, it's the shot you're not expecting and you're really not positioned and poised to take it and eat it. So it could be a combination of both. It was the right shot at the right time. And either way, do you think, based on what we know about what Wiley Zhang had done previously, we always get into this immediate rematch stuff. Do you think she deserves one? Do you think that there's another? Well, for a couple of reasons. One, do you think she deserves one based on what she did in winning the championship and defending it? And secondly, you start looking up and down that rankings, and it's not too much happening there. So what do you think?
Robert Whittaker has like three opponents in his rearview mirror, and he's just screaming at Dana White, like, really? You're going to give her a title shot? I know I got knocked out too, but like, come on. Because for Whaley, we got to get to a certain point where there has to be a cutoff. Like, unless you defended your title three times, I don't want to see you get an immediate rematch. I don't. I really do think after you beat the champ, you are the champ. Like, you are the person. You don't need to prove that you need to beat them again. Like, that's one of the dumber narratives, I think, just across combat sports is, oh, maybe you beat the champ by decision, but you didn't finish them. Who cares? That's not the rules of the sport. The rules is, I get the dub. I leave with the belt. And for Whaley, yes, everyone respects her because she was one half of arguably the greatest fight in UFC history. I really do hold Joanna Whaley in that kind of regard. Like, that's one of the greatest fights I've ever seen in my life. She doesn't deserve an immediate rematch, though. She got knocked out in a minute and 10 seconds. Could you imagine if LeBron James in the finals one year just didn't play, scored like 3 points per game, averaged an assist, and was like, listen, guys, I'll do it again next year. People would be like, no, you're done. You're washed. So I just don't get – you're right. The division is sort of stagnant, but there's a couple people coming up that you could look towards to see for a compelling contender. Mackenzie Dern is a name that does not get enough respect, and I'm here to start campaigning for Mackenzie Dern versus Rose Namajunas. Here is what I would do if I was Dana White. Now, I'm not Dana White. I'm much taller. I'm much, I guess, lighter, I guess, and I have much more hair. But I would do Whaley versus Joanna too. Have that be a fight night main event. Now, I understand it's really hard to make those two fighters go through a similar fight to their first fight if you don't have gold on the line. But personally, I would do Whaley versus Joanna. Joanna's been away for a while, and her last fight was Whaley too. So you do that for the title eliminator, and then you have Mackenzie Dern versus Rose Namajunas for the title. Because I got to be honest, I don't care about Carla Esparza in this division nearly as much as I probably should. I understand she was at least rumored to be in there with Whaley, but I really don't want to see Carla versus Rose too. I understand Carla has the win over Rose. So hey, maybe, okay, as I'm saying it out loud, it makes a little bit of sense. But personally, I would look towards Mackenzie Dern. She's done a lot of heavy lifting, and when she did have her lone loss in the UFC to Amanda Ribas, she immediately rebuilt herself, and she's become a way better fighter as a result. And if you want new blood in this division, you're going to have to look outside of that weird triangle of Joanna, Rose, and Whaley eventually. And with Jessica Andrade sort of leaving the division, I know we'll get to her fight in a second. I just really don't know what's next for Rose if you don't look towards a Mackenzie Dern or maybe a Tatiana Suarez if she can ever get her neck healed up. Because you're right, strawweight, I would say, is the most talent-rich division in women's MMA right now, but that's only because bantamweight's not very good. It's completely cleaned out, and flyweight's still kind of settling itself out, and it has such a dominant champion. Strawweight's really only good because it's the last one left at a certain point, and I think there will be contenders on their way up who, I think this belt's really going to change hands quite a few times, if we're being honest, but I think eventually the UFC is going to have to look outside of that Joanna, Rose, Whaley. I understand those are the three fighters who can draw the most in that weight class, but at a certain point, you do have to look outside of just those headliners.
Yeah, I'm with you. My only pushback would be, I mean, I don't know how old Esparza is, but she feels like an old fighter. She feels like she's not long for this. That's what I mean. Like, she's been around a while. If it's me, I put Whaley on the shelf for a little bit. I give Esparza the rematch with Rose because she finished her. So it's not like she just won. She finished her. I give Carla the rematch because, you know, clock's ticking on her. And dude, I put Mackenzie Dern in there with Joanna on Jacek. And I say, okay, you're telling me your hands are better? Then show me. If you want to earn this shot, then earn this shot. I think Joanna on Jacek and Mackenzie Dern is a legitimate winner gets a title shot fight. Do you know what I mean? And that's
where I really like Mackenzie Dern, and that's an awful fight for her.
Yeah. I think that's – I don't know. I mean – but listen, no,
that is right.
For me, I'm one of these guys that I look at fighters in terms of, like, how much time do I have with this guy, right? What could go wrong, right? Meaning I was advocating for a Cody Garbrandt title shot a couple of months ago, only because I'm like, he's going to go off the rails at some point. So let's maximize the fact that he has a big name by putting him in there with Jan before he fought Aljamain. And I was like, that's the thing. You let Jan go in there, clean out Garbrandt. It's another big name on his resume before Cody Garbrandt does something that's going to derail him, a bad performance, something outside of the cage. I'm not saying that I look at Esparza the same way. I'm just saying that I look at Esparza like, you know, I've gotten enough vibes from her that she might not be long for this thing, or she might have like other stuff she wants to do. Let's make this official. Carlos Esparza, 33. I mean, I don't hate it, but she's been fighting for a minute. She made her debut 2010, so she's been fighting 11 years. She's not in the twilight of her career, but I just want to see, you know, listen, if I'm wrong about Esparza, she fights, either beats or loses to Rose, and then maybe there's a trilogy fight 5 years from now because I wrote her off too early, or 3 years from now. You do the fight now, you give Dern one chance to sort of – and listen, maybe you don't give Dern Jan Jacek. Maybe you're right. Maybe you give Jan Jacek and Wiley Zhang the fight again, but you just give Dern another fight, another 3, 4, 5 months with Jason Perillo. You know, because if she goes in there, I'm telling you, I'm not making any predictions here. I think that Rose can hang with McKenzie in the grappling. I'm not saying she's better. I'm saying she can hang with her. Hold on. She can hang with her, and she's way better on the feet.
McKenzie Dern submitted Gabby Garcia, who outweighs her by like 100 pounds. It's not – Craig falls into this trap where he just sees black belt and he just assumes that that's a blanket term and that black belt applies across everybody. Mackenzie Dern, if she looks at you the wrong way on the ground, your arm breaks. She has that one punch, one kill jujitsu. That's the only way I can describe it. I look at her and Brian Ortega and Charles Oliveira as the few people in the sport where, like, I don't care if you drop them and they are almost completely unconscious. You don't go for more ground to pound on those guys. You let them get back up to your feet because that's how dangerous they are. But I do agree with what you said. I think you laid out a pretty good path for Carla Esparza, and you are right. If she is able to get that win over Rose, that would make for a great title trilogy right afterwards too. It would be another excuse to throw Rose in there. So I think you did change my mind, honestly. Carla Esparza versus Rose would probably be a really good idea for the next title shot. And another name too that doesn't get that much respect, Yan Xiaonan. I know she hasn't been the most active as of late, but there was real talk that we were going to get her versus Wei Li at some point. So hopefully they get her in there with maybe a Joanna or one of those other top names. But it will be really interesting because it does feel like Andrade, Rose, Wei Li, and Joanna. Those are the names that are just kind of synonymous with the strawweight division. Like every time there's a title fight, one of those four fighters has been involved. So it will be really interesting to see how this division moves forward.
All right, Matt, let's do like Jessica Andrade and move from strawweight to flyweight and talk about Valentina Shevchenko. Matt, as Amanda Nunes has been building her resume as the greatest women's, maybe the greatest MMA fighter, no qualifier of all time, Valentina Shevchenko has been quietly busting every ass they send her. And Jessica Andrade was no different. Every way Shevchenko wanted to fight and everything she wanted to do went with little to no disruption from Andrade, and fans of the Matt Hughes Royce Gracie fight from UFC 60 were certainly happy to see the finish in this one as the bullet crucifixed out Andrade and closed the curtains with elbows and punches to an undefended face. Matt, what are we going to do with Shevchenko? I mean, her division is all but cleaned out. It's not completely cleaned out, and we'll get to that, but it's all but cleaned out. She doesn't seem to have any answers for Amanda Nunes. She got closer in the last fight. Talk to me about what you saw in this fight and really what's next for the Bullet.
So, okay, if we're going to give Valentina her credit, let's just look at who her opponent was in this fight. Because here was my problem with calling Valentina, you know, the women's goat or putting her on that same level with Amanda. She beat Jessica Eye and Caitlin Chookagian. I don't care. I'm sorry. Those mean something, but they really don't mean that much as title challengers. Like, John Jones really proved that not all title defenses are created equal. Like, he defended his title against Rampage and Gustafson and an earlier Glover and Daniel Cormier. Like, real killers who, if he made any mistakes, were going to make him pay for them. Valentina Shevchenko could have probably not had a training camp and still beat Jessica Ai. Jessica Andrade has beaten number one contenders in three different divisions, though. She's beaten Raquel Pennington at 135. She was the champ at 120 or at 115, sorry. And then she knocked out the number one contender of this division in her last fight. Jessica Andrade is low-key one of the greatest women's MMA fighters of all time. It's just her record's kind of salty because she's only fought the best of the best of the best since she's joined the UFC. And I finally thought that we were going to get a competitive Valentina fight. I thought, finally, Jennifer Maia, she showed that you can hold Shevchenko down. She's not the strongest off of her back. Yes, she has submission abilities, but you can at least hold her down if you're a physically strong fighter. What I think physically strong fighters, one of the first fighters who comes to mind, regardless of gender or weight class, is Jessica Andrade. So I thought to myself, hey, maybe she can catch her with a shot, overwhelm her, and get her to the mat. None of that happened at all. And Valentina, like you said, I don't know what you do next because it's not just that she's cleared out her division. There has yet to be a competitive fight in her division. Like the closest fight she's had was probably the Joanna fight way back when. And that fight was closer than a lot of people remember, I think. But still, it wasn't some nail biter when the judges were bringing in their scorecards. Everyone knew Valentina was the rightful winner at the end of the day. So I know Lauren Murphy, the Fight Night Picks 2020 Female Fighter of the Year is out there. And listen, she is scrappy as they come and no one's given up. Lauren Murphy's not going to give up in there with Valentina Shevchenko. And that's one of the few things I can guarantee. But Lauren Murphy could clone herself and have two of her in there. I doubt she beats Valentina Shevchenko. That's just the big skill gap that we're dealing with in this division. So for Valentina, unless she does do like the Anderson Silva and just be like, I'll fight number one contenders at 135 and maybe not fight Amanda, that's really all I can see her doing next. Because I'm like you, were the first two fights close? Yes, they were. Was the second one very, very close? Yes, it was. But Amanda's also improved since their fights. That's what people forget. Everyone's like, oh, it was an early version of Valentina. It was an early Amanda Nunes, too. We're still seeing Amanda Nunes get better fight in and fight out. So maybe that fight could be competitive. And I forget who tweeted out. I forget. It might have been Aaron Braunsteiner, but he was like, the only person who can beat Amanda Nunes is Valentina. And the only person who can beat Valentina is Amanda. Why not match them up for the third time? But personally, I would do what the UFC did with Anderson Silva, where he didn't fight for the belt at 205, but it seemed like every 3 years he would just fight at 205. Like he fought Forrest Griffin that one time, he fought Stephen Bonner. Like he would have those weird one-offs. Maybe if they want to do like, hey Valentina, do you want to fight Jermaine Duran to me? It's a weird fight, but people might like it. That's really all I can see them doing with her, like do a weird super fight title. Because there's not a single fighter in that division where you can even make somewhat of an argument that they can beat Shevchenko at this point.
So here's my pushback, which is I think that occasionally you do have to just give somebody something they earned. I feel like Lauren Murphy's earned the shot. And if the reality is, you know, the old saying of like, you know, in other sports, you win in a tournament and they go, congratulations, you finish eighth in the East. Your reward is you get to play the Nets. I think it's like, you know, Lauren Murphy, quote unquote, earned the right to maybe get her ass whipped by Valentina Shevchenko. But I think she's earned the fight. Obviously, she's booked with Calderwood, so we'll see what happens there. I don't know that she'll ever have what it takes to beat Valentina. So I do think she should get the fight, but I don't know if she has enough. But here's my next question. Do you think there's any version of Alexa Grasso that could ever get close to Valentina? I mean, I see some things in Grasso. I don't know that she's an all-timer. Valentina's an all-timer. I mean, she's going to be one of the – we're going to be talking about her long after her career is done. Do you see that in Grasso or not?
There's not a snowball's chance in hell that Grasso has a chance against Valentina. Here's the problem. I've seen Alexa Grasso get controlled on the ground for so many minutes in every single one of her fights. Like, Felice Herrig was able to get ground and pound off on her. Do you know what Valentina would be able to do to her porous takedown defense? But I do agree with you. On the feet, someone like Grasso, or at least a striker with her style, that long, rangy kind of boxing, but she can get really nice kicks off too, it's going to take someone with that style. But this is my problem with Shevchenko, and I hate it when I say this, but it is the truth. If you're going to beat Shevchenko, you have to make it the most boring fight ever and hope the judges are really educated at this point. Because Shevchenko, I don't think Valentina Shevchenko isn't an exciting fighter. She's a fighter who, when given the better, when given certain matchups, can have an exciting result. Because the majority of Shevchenko fights, if you just stand there on the feet with her, she doesn't really do that much. She just stands there, bounces, and then tries to counter over and over and over again. I think it's going to take a fighter, and maybe Lauren Murphy, to make up for her lack of skills, could go in there with a game plan of, I'm just barely going to throw anything at her. I'm not going to give her any looks. I'm not going to let her get my timing. I'm going to be very firm in my case of, I'm just going to be boring. I'm going to maybe land 7 significant strikes this round to her 5 and hope that the judges take that into account. But right now, Murphy, I agree with you. She probably should be the rightful challenger, but yeah, I'm just finding it really hard to find a compelling matchup out there for Shevchenko. And it sucks because she's one of those fighters who, do I think she'll ever be a superstar? No. She's a great example of what I always think of like a co-main champion. Like, she's never going to headline a pay-per-view. But if you have, you know, Volkanovski versus Brian Ortega, she can make a very good co-main for that. It's just getting to the point where she's getting into that Amanda Nunes zone where you're just sort of running out of bodies to throw at her.
Yeah, I think Shevchenko isn't my experience with her, and maybe I'm remembering her recent fights poorly, but like, she seems like she keeps her eye on the prize. And I think that if you're going to get somebody, much like Mike Tyson or anybody else in history, you got to hope a couple things have to come together. You have to be an able enough fighter to capitalize on them having an off night, right? Holly Holm was an able enough fighter on a night when Ronda Rousey had an off night. Now, she could have just been a horrible matchup and would have won every time she fought Rousey, but Rousey had a lot of things going on. And when she let her guard down, you know, Holm was ready to pounce on her, and that's how it worked out. So there has to be somebody who's ready to pounce. And I think Murphy has a good coaching staff in her history. She's got some skills. I don't know if she has the power that she would need. Because if you're going to beat Shevchenko, I don't think she could beat her over 5 rounds. I think she'd have to, you know, stun her. So, all right, let's move on. Listen, we're not going to talk about this too long, but it's Uriah Hall. It's Chris Weidman. Weidman obviously has his knee or his leg absolutely shattered. You know, a lot of things here that, you know, obviously that happened when he fought Anderson Silva the second time. Obviously, he's fought Uriah Hall before. So, and listen, I was watching the fights last night with some buddies of mine. And, you know, Uriah Hall's a stand-up guy. He said everything you would expect him to say in that spot. But I said to my buddies, if I'm Chris Weidman, I would never fight Uriah Hall again. If I'm Uriah Hall, I would never fight Chris Weidman again. And I'm not even superstitious. It's just like, what? Why even put that into the world? It's not really a necessary fight. Just like, let's pretend this never happened. Let Weidman heal up and go on with our lives. Is there anything to add to this? It's just a sad situation, right?
It really is. It's terrible. And Chris Weidman's just had a tough second stretch of his career, you know? And it does suck. Like, sometimes you have champions, and when they lose their title, they can still stick around and be a real player in the top 5, in the top 10. Think about Junior Dos Santos. Like, after Cain Velasquez beat him the first time, he still beat the brakes off of most guys in the heavyweight division until, you know, age finally did catch up to him. With Weidman, whatever led to his downfall led to his downfall, whether it just was an accumulation of damage at a certain point, whether it was some accusations about a certain United States anti-doping agency and when they came in and his results. But it just sucks, and I wish there was a better way to say it. I wish there was a better way to break this down, but it's just awful to see. You and I understand probably better than most just how underpaid and undervalued these fighters are, and for someone like him to go through an injury like that, if he ever does come back, it's not going to be for at least a year, and that's on the best stage of things. Like, I was thinking, when fighters tear their ACL, that's a red flag for me. You know what's a real big red flag? When there's a clean break straight through their shin. So it just sucks. Again, I don't really know what Weidman does after this. I don't know if he decides, like, maybe this is it. Maybe he does want to just have one more to be like, hey, I still am that guy. But I agree with you. Whether Weidman comes back 100% or not, why make these guys fight each other again? There was zero animosity coming into this fight. There was that weird, like, hey, is Long Island a part of New York or not? I'm not from the area. I couldn't tell you. But there wasn't that much of a heated buildup. Like, both guys are really respectful towards each other. Let's just move on from this. And for Uriah Hall, it sucks because he's been on this really good stretch throughout his career. I would say it's taken him... I don't know a lot about wine, but I do know they're supposed to get better as they age. And it does seem like Uriah Hall, although strikers like him normally, who rely on their speed and their athleticism, normally they age very fast, but he's almost become smarter as he's gotten older, and that's really helped his offense. So you know a guy like him doesn't want to win that way. And for Uriah Hall, it'll be interesting now, because if you're the matchmaker, do you look at this fight and treat this as a statement win for Uriah Hall? Like, do you treat this the same way as if he went out there and head kicked Chris Weidman in the first round? Probably not, because let's say he goes out there and finishes Weidman in like a Gegard Mousasi kind of way, where it's a highlight reel and Weidman's out cold. Then Uriah Hall's probably looking at a, probably not these opponents, but like the Vittoris, the Whitakers of the world, like that top three, top four space. If you're Uriah Hall, you're probably just getting another guy in that like 7 to 15 range. So it sucks that Hall isn't able to really benefit from this anyway either. But yeah, this is just, it was gross. It was terrible. It's weird how the first two fights on the main card both involved leg injuries. I know we'll get to the second one after, but just a crazy way to start off this main card.
Yeah, so a couple questions for you about this. Number one, do you think that, you know, people kind of forgot about the Anderson Silva thing? And, oh, before I forget, one suggestion I had last night with some friends was the timeline does line up, because typically they like to do the Brooklyn card in November. So, I mean, he could make a recovery and then make the Brooklyn card 2022. I mean, if we're thinking about, like, a way to end your career, that might be a nice way to end his career. And honestly, it would be a nice subplot if him and Uriah Hall, who are both from New York, fought there. But, I mean, again, I'm not advocating they fight each other. But if you're going to put them together, why not put them on the Brooklyn card? But that's a long way away. So the question I have is, does this have anything to do with this, I don't say recent, but fairly recent, interest in calf kicks? Do you think – now, people sort of shook the Anderson thing off because it was so fluky. Now it's happened twice, and it's still fluky. But do you think fighters in any way in the back of their mind are going to be like, man, why don't I throw these kicks? I'm really, or do you think it's just like fighters are like, I've thrown 1,000 kicks. It's never happened to me. It never will.
It's too big of a benefit. That's the problem. Like,
yeah.
Okay, I'm going to go back to The Last Dance. Remember when Michael Jordan breaks his foot in his sophomore season and they're telling him, hey, if you break this bone again, you're never going to play. And they're trying to speak to him in a way to get him to understand. And the owner goes to him and says, hey, if I offered you a bottle with 10 Tylenol pills in it and 9 of them cured your headache, but 1 of them killed you, would you take the pill? And Michael Jordan says, it depends on how fucking bad the pain is. So yeah. Fighters who are already risky individuals to begin with, they're going to take that risk. It's too big of a benefit, because if you do catch someone in the right spot and kill their front leg, it's too big of a benefit to think, hey, in the back of my mind, maybe I'll have a 2 in what seems like a million chance happen. Because it has been weird. And I'm glad you brought this up, because I've been thinking about this a little bit too, where a lot of MMA fights, especially if you look at like regional shows or even like Bellator prelims and whatnot, when fighters don't have a lot of fights, a lot of fighters who only have 2-3 fights in their career just resort to like a leg kicking competition. They just go after the calf, they just go after the leg, because they know it's such a beneficial technique. If you're a fighter and you know how much you can benefit off it, I really doubt that they're going to be looking at it that way. And I think you would get fighters being more hesitant if we did see more catastrophic injuries like this with the uptick in calf kicks. But I mean, people have been using calf kicks for 2-3 years now, pretty, maybe not that long in every single fight, but it's been a well-known technique for at least a couple of years now. And the fact that we have only seen this injury twice now, I doubt it. But if anything, this shows, you know what the best thing you can do is? Learn how to check calf kicks. Because yeah. No one's going to throw a calf kick at you if you check the first one. And if they do try to do it and you check the second one, that's how you get injuries like the Chris Weidman. Like, the defense against the technique, I just think, is a really important thing to teach and to learn for a lot of these fighters.
All right, Matt, speaking of leg injuries, let's move on. Matt, former title challenger Anthony Smith, is somewhere at this point in his career between gatekeeper and championship contender. Jimmy Crute came to the cage looking to get himself near a title shot on Smith's back. And early on, it looked like a war of attrition had begun. Smith's jab was competing with Crute's leg kicks to see which fighter would have to turn to defense first and abandon their main offensive weapon. In the end, it was not the jab, but a well-placed kick by Smith that turned Crute's foot rubber and left the referee no choice but to wave it off. Matt, was this bad luck for Crute? Or did the kick just sort of speed up the inevitable, which was that jab was really taking him apart?
That jab really was taking him apart. And that was that's kind of the main technique of that fight when I think back to it. Yes, the leg kick was the thing that stopped it and made Jim Crute, of course, have to stop him between the rounds. But the jab of Anthony Smith was something to behold. It was almost like he was just like, no, get away from me, get away from me, get away from me. And just flicking that thing out every single time. And the accuracy that he had on it, he wasn't hitting glove every time he threw the jab out. Like, he threw it with intentions to blind and to stun Jim Crute every single time he threw it, which was a great technique from Smith. The only pushback I'll give on if it was the inevitable was Jim Crute got the takedown immediately after. That was the most compelling part of round one. Was it seems like his leg goes dead. He realizes, oh shit, I have to go for a takedown now. And then he immediately does get the takedown. Smith gets up to his feet. Then he gets him back down again. If Crute was able to continue in that second and third round, I'm sure he would have just tried to continue to wrestle. And maybe he would be able to the point where Anthony Smith just gets exhausted and Crute could get two rounds off him, maybe finish him. But no, once you get an injury like that, I normally think you should probably err on the side of caution, because for Crute, what does having your leg or, you know, ankle snap onto you do for your career? Like, having a loss via leg injury to Anthony Smith in your, 14th fight isn't going to ruin any of his height. Jim Crute's still a really good prospect, and I think he's going to learn from this. That's the great thing about MMA. If this was boxing, then yeah, Jim Crute probably would be done, and we wouldn't look at him as still a pretty exciting prospect. But the fact that he got jabbed by a guy who fought for a title not that long ago, and that he ended the fight due to an injury, I don't think it really hurts the stock of Jim Crute. And honestly, I think this is one of those fights that it kind of helps both guys. Anthony Smith needed a top-level win. His last win was Devin Clark, and I mean, he was losing to most top-level guys before that, after his title shot, of course. And for Jim Crute, it's just back to the drawing board. You either win or you learn. He's still a young guy, and I think he's got a lot of room to grow.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think it helped both guys, but this is the best case scenario for both of them moving forward. Is, you know, Crute has the built-in excuse. Smith looks sharp early and ultimately gets the win, so it works out. All right, let's move on to the prelims. If you like me butchering names, you're gonna have a blast here on this one. Not this fight, but this prelim card. Let's start with Randy Brown defeating Alex Oliveira by submission via rear naked choke. A one-hander. It seemed to me like the cage helped a little bit on that one, didn't it?
Do you remember when Alex Oliveira was really good, though? Like, yeah. Alex Oliveira at one point was a real player at 170. I feel like everyone forgets this. They just realize him because they hear all those like urban myths about him and possibly like a lot of kids down in Brazil. And you just hear about all the crazy stuff he does inside the cage now. But yeah, after he knocked out Ryan LaFleur, I didn't think he was going to win the title or anything. But I was like, damn, if Alex Oliveira gets a couple decent wins, like, he can beat guys in the top 15. That's all done now. And I think Oliveira is one of those fighters who damage eventually is going to catch up to you. You can't fight like he does on the prelims every other day and not expect the damage to catch up with you. He's only 33 years old. Is that not the craziest stat you've ever heard in your life? Am I the only one who's freaking out about this? He seems like he's 75. Now, he does still have a pop in his step, I guess. He's not completely shop-worn. He just doesn't accept damage like he used to. He can't eat shots like he used to. Now, when he gets hit clean, it does wobble him, and it seems to wobble him every time. But for Randy Brown, we need to get like a Randy Brown respect post or like appreciation day or something, because Randy Brown is my new Vicente Luque. Because Luque was that guy outside the rankings that no one in the rankings wanted to fight. And it just kind of sucked, because you knew that a bunch of guys who weren't really qualified to fight Luque had to just be thrown in there and fight him, because no one else who was good was willing to get in there. Randy Brown's last loss was a TKO to Vicente Luque. There's no shame in that whatsoever. There's been a lot of guys in their careers who have been coming off of TKO losses to Vicente Luque. And it feels like everyone just kind of forgot about Randy Brown. But you look at the size of him for this division, his ability to wrestle, his ability to strike on the outside. He should learn how to check calf kicks, granted. But I really do think Randy Brown's one of those dark horses outside the rankings who, on his best day, could he beat a guy like a, you know, Leon Edwards? Maybe not. But I think Randy Brown's in that like Bilal Muhammad category, where if he gets on a good run, I really do think he can beat any guy in the world.
Yeah, you know, and Randy Brown to me reminds me of a kind of guy. You know, we talk about who's the next guy, right? Like, we've said forever, who's the next Masvidal? You know, Randy Brown could be like, who's the next Kevin Holland? The guy that has skills and then gets a push because the right things happen. This fight falls out. He takes it and wins. And I think that I'm with you. I think that he has skills where if he has an epiphany moment or the right opportunity, he could, like, you know, strap a rocket to his ass. And next thing
and he's exciting, too. This is what – Craig hates it when I bring this up because he disagrees with me, but this really does matter. MMA is one of the few sports where the more exciting you are, the faster you're going to go up the rankings. Like, just because Steph Curry's fun to watch doesn't mean his teams always win. Now, they do because he's really good, and that's how basketball works. But, like, Elias Theodoro was beating everybody by split decision on the prelims, and it took him forever to get a ranked opponent. When the UFC finally gave him a ranked opponent, it was Derek Brunson who beat him, and then they cut ties with Elias. Like, Randy Brown is an exciting fighter, and I don't think people realize just how much that helps you when you are trying to get a ranked opponent.
I agree. We move on to the next fight, which is Dwight Grant defeated Stefan Sekulic via split decision, 29-28, 28-29, 29-28. What'd you have here?
Is it fair to say this was the only dud on the card? Not a great fight. It's probably Dwight Grant. He does have really good power, but he just seems so off balance every time he throws. Like, he never plants. Think about the shot that Usman took Masvidal out with. Like, he planted and threw through Masvidal. When Grant throws, he always seems to have, like, 1 foot off the ground. It's always just, it's really unique, I guess. But against Stefan Sekulic, you knew that Sekulic had the wrestling. He's good defensively. It just, nothing really happened for the first two rounds. And I saw there was a lot of heat about the decision. A lot of people felt like Sekulic won. But the way I looked at this fight was, nobody really won those first two rounds. Like, we can go back and forth, and maybe to you, the takedowns count for a little more. And to me, the strikes of Grant count for a little more. But really, at the end of the day, did anyone do enough to win that first round? Not at all. Did anyone do enough to win the second round? Not at all. In the third round, though, Sekulic almost knocked Dwight Grant out and took him down immediately at the end of the fight. So when I just look at the fight as a total, Sekulic was really the only one who won any moments in the fight. I understand that's not how fights are judged, but still, I thought Sekulic probably edged it, but really not much to talk about on this fight. I doubt either guy has the highest ceiling. And for Grant, he's 37, I believe. He's not as young as you'd like from a guy who's not in the rankings just yet. So for Grant, there's a lot of exciting fights out there. I'd like to see maybe him and Santiago Ponzinibbio. It's a name. Ponzinibbio used to be in the top 15. Then he suffered that terrible KO loss to Li Jingliang. So maybe they could have a fight. Just listen, we have two strikers. It's probably going to result in a fun fight if nothing else. But yeah, not much to say about that one.
As we move on, Brendan Allen, who would be the Jim Neidhart in the Hart Foundation with our Allen brothers. Brendan Allen defeated Carl Roberson by submission via heel hook. 455 round one. What'd you have in this one?
Brendan Allen got hands all of a sudden. That was cool. Like, Brendan Allen, not just physically, they kind of, if you look at the both shoulders down, Mervyn Vettori and Brendan Allen are basically the same guy. Like, they're built very similar. They have a very similar game. The only difference was Vittori's really good at striking his way into the clinch. Like, he's got that high guard. He knows how to be smart defensively. He knows how to get close to you, and then he can use his wrestling and his great ground and pound. Brendan Allen has that wrestling. He has the ground and pound. He has the jiu-jitsu and the submissions. He just never had the striking to get himself in range. And at the start of this fight, listen, Roberson's a fast striker, and he's a dangerous kickboxer for really anybody at 185. But Allen figured out, if I blitz him and crash that distance, he's not going to have the space to get off those kicks and whatnot. And once Allen was able to get this fight to the ground, it was interesting because it seemed like Allen was pretty much dominating, and then Roberson gets that sweep, and then Roberson thinks he's getting a heel hook on Brendan Allen. But Brendan Allen, the much superior grappler, was like, no, call the police for yourself, not for me. And he was able to get that heel hook. So it was just a really nice performance from Allen. And fighters win fights all the time, but Brendan Allen showed me something new in one of his fights, and that was the important thing. I know Brendan Allen could go out there and ground and pound guys. Like, if he just went out there, ground and pound at Carl Roberson until Roberson gave his back and choked him out, I'd be like, okay, I know Brendan Allen can do that. But the fact that he did seem a lot more comfortable on his feet, and that the move down to Sanford MMA has seemed to help him in the striking department, I do think Brendan Allen's an exciting prospect to look out for in the future.
Moving on, Patrick Sabatini defeated Tristan Connolly via unanimous decision, 30-27 and 229-28. What'd you have here?
The quote, who's the old guy who wore the cowboy hat in WWE? I forget, but he used to use the term tougher than a $2 steak. That's what Tristan Connolly is. He is tough. You don't go for fighting Michelle Paheya at 170 and then going down to 145 after basically a year and a half layoff. So respect to Tristan Connolly, but Pat Sabatini's a monster on the ground. He really was. And he just seemed to have an answer for everything Connolly was trying to do. And Sabatini would get on top and Connolly would try to buck. He'd try to shrimp out, but Sabatini was just so much better on the ground. He was reacting to everything really well. So a great win for Sabatini. And that fight was a lot like when Joe Selecki beat Jim Miller. Was it the most exciting fight of all time? No, but Pat Sabatini was just really dominant the whole way through.
Danah Bacharel defeated Kevin Natavad via TKO. 50 seconds of round one. What'd you have here?
Danah Bacharel. Wow. That was nice. That was just a really nice counter. The fact that he went, he did that Izzy combo. I don't know why the commentary didn't pick up on this, but I always think of Adesanya where he throws the right high kick, and as he's bringing his foot down, he throws the right hand to like match it almost. That's what Bacharel did. He goes left high kick as he's bringing, or sorry, right high kick as he's bringing the kick down, tries to go right hook, and then steps back and left hooks him. Beautiful striking by Danah Bacharel. Just a really, really nice sequence from him. It's hard to break down much of a 50-second fight, but he looked really, really good. That's high-level striking from a guy that early on in the card.
Kazula Vargas defeated Rong Zhu via unanimous decision, 30-26, couple 29-28. What'd you have here?
Some fighters don't know how to taunt. I know that's a weird thing to say, but you know how like football teams practice their celebrations? Rong Zhu needs to practice his like celebrations in the cage, or he has to practice when he's going to taunt inside the cage, because it seemed like he'd move out of the way of one punch and try to do like the matador wave the cape, and then he'd get hit five times after that. Like, hey, stop being Betch Kohea. That's the last fighter you want to act like in the cage. So for Kazulu, it was a good win for a guy who needed one, but he barely won that fight. It was just all the rounds were fairly close. He just kind of edged it. But the last two fights, the first two fights of the night, might have been the best card fights on the whole entire card.
And let's get to those. Jeffrey Molina defeated Aori Zhang via unanimous decision. A couple 29-28 and 29-27. What'd you have here?
So Archie Lang. That's how you say his name. I didn't know that, and Craig taught me. So it's Archie Lang. Archie Lang had a lot of hype coming into this fight, and you heard that too from the commentary. They were really Archie Lang. Yeah, there you go. We both learned some. But Jeff Molina just looked good in that fight. It was one of those fights where Archie Lang looked good. He was the more technical fighter. He was the more explosive striker. But once that power bar did start to diminish and he did start to get tired, Jeff Molina just kind of overwhelmed him with volume as the fight progressed. So it was a really nice fight from Molina. And here's the good and the bad news about 125 right now in the men's side of things. Flyweight's a good division, and it has a ton of great fighters. But to me, it feels like you have the top 15, and then you've got like those four guys who are on the outside of it, because it's not the deepest division in the world. And there's such a separation between what I would consider ranked flyweights and everyone else that I really don't know who they're going to match them up with next. But it was a great performance by Molina.
Last year, Arian Carnelosi defeated Liang Na via TKO, 128 round two. What'd you have here?
These two went to war for as long as this fight lasted. Just a wild fight, like back and forth, back and forth. Carnelosi was able to finish her in the end. Just again, I really can't get over just how well this whole card delivered. Like, that's really my message as we go down through this whole entire card. It's not often that you don't really have a dud in the middle of it. Yeah, there were a couple fights that didn't promise like everything else, but as you go through the card and just look at everything. So we started off finishing the first fight of the night, finishing the second fight of the night. Or sorry, it was finish, fight of the night, decision, finish, decision, and then finish to end the night. Like, it was an absolutely wild night of fights. And I do think that when you get the fights or the night started off with two, and I'm going to use the term relatively unknowns in Carnelosi and Liang Na, and when they're willing to go out there in front of a crowd and you have that energy starting off the night, I just feel like it really just kicked off the whole card in the best way possible. So that was a crazy fight for the start.
All right, let's hit the wrap. We'll start with some housekeeping. Performance of the night, Kamaru Usman and Jorge Masvidal, $50,000 to Usman. Performance of the night, Wiley Zhang and Rose Namajunas, $50,000 to Rose Namajunas. And Jeff Molina and Archie Lang, $50,000 to each fighter for fight of the night. Do you agree with all those?
I don't think Uriah Hall was going to get one, so yeah. I do. Like, Valentina looked really good, but here's the thing. And if we're going to somehow say, like, oh, this finish was better than another one, Usman's knockout was standing, and there's something to be said for a standing knockout. Like, when you hit a guy so hard that he is unconscious before he hits the ground, that's something to be said. And it's the other one is a head kick knockout. You're out of your mind if you're going to beat a head kick knockout. There's a lot of great performances on that card. If you want it, I got to be – hopefully they did the Randy Brown, like, a discretional bonus. Like, hey, you won via one-arm rear naked choke. We're going to give you, like, 10 grand out back, just because that really was an impressive performance, and the way that he was able to win that was really nice. But, no, I agree with all those bonuses.
Let's talk about where you were right. What'd you see that maybe either Craig or the public didn't see? What were the stuff that you hit on?
I hate that I'm about to make this joke again. I said Uriah Hall was going to win by TKO. There, I'm done. my lock of the night was I thought Randy Brown was going to beat Alex Oliveira, and I was confident about that fight. Now, was I nervous when Oliveira landed those calf kicks early on? I was, but that just seemed like a weird fight because when I think of Randy Brown, I do think of a fighter on the up. I understand he was coming off a loss, but I don't think of Randy Brown as a fighter who has already done a lot of his career. He's a fighter who has more to accomplish in the future, where Oliveira... Is the term club fighter rude to throw around? But at this point, he feels like kind of the UFC's version of what a club fighter is. Am I excited when Alex Oliveira is fighting? Of course I am, because I know he's one of the few fighters who's going to give it their all no matter what, from the first second they're in there until they're out. But that was just a really weird fight going into it. The other one that I feel like I got right was the Brennan Allen Carl Roberson fight. That fight was going to go one way or the other. It was going to be Roberson knocks him out on the feet, or Allen just kind of ragdolls him on the mat. But Brennan Allen just looked phenomenal. I really can't say enough about how much he did look improved in this fight. So, yeah, that was my little victory tour. I was wrong, though, on this card, too. I got to be honest. There was a few. I think I went 9-4 with my predictions all in all. But I said Jessica Andrade was going to make it a competitive fight. And I really thought that she was going to be in there and have like a knock him down, drag him out kind of a war with Shevchenko. Even though I predicted Shevchenko, I still feel like I read that fight completely wrong.
All right, let's move on to some takeaways for tonight. From last night, I mean. You know, I was talking to my friends again, and it dawned on me, you know, we probably watched 3 Hall of Famers last night. You know, Kamaru Usman, Rosnami Yunus, and Valentina Shevchenko. I think last night Rose probably sealed her, you know, they started sewing her jacket last night. This is the second time she's
who's Chris before? Weidman.
Well, I Chris mean, Weidman. No, I meant who that were impressive.
Weidman's sorry, there. My bad.
Weidman's there, but I'm saying we watched 3 Hall of Famers like look good, all you know, either defend or win titles. But they're 3 unlikely Hall of Famers. Like if I asked someone to start listing off future Hall of Famers, it would take you a minute to get to, for sure, Usman, but beyond that, Nama Yunus and Shevchenko. Do you think that we're giving these 3 their flowers? Do you think that they're really appreciated for what they are?
Yes and no. Now, I'm a little bit younger than you. I don't know if you can tell by the color of our hair, but... I don't remember LeBron on his way up. I just remember LeBron from like 2007 on, because I would have been like 8 at that point and I can still remember basketball and whatnot. So I don't remember them comparing him to MJ on the way up, but that's kind of the curse that Kamaru Usman has associated with him right now. It's either you're better than GSP and you're the best welterweight of all time, or you're kind of in his shadow, it feels like. And it's a shame because, again, I think we've broken down pretty good. Like Kamaru Usman has all those star qualities, and you remember in Rocky Balboa, that the one that came out in like 2007, 2008, it was like the one that came out way later. When they did that, ESPN did the simulation and they were like, if Rocky Balboa fought the current champion in his prime, how would that fight go? It's starting to become interesting if we did have that technology. If GSP in his prime fought Kamaru Usman of last night, who would win? Because when I look at what GSP's claim to being the greatest of all time is his accomplishments and what he has accomplished, but just what GSP and what he matches up with Kamaru Usman, I'm starting to not be as confident that GSP would win that matchup every single time. You know, like right now, GSP would beat Usman, but only about 6 times out of 10. It's no longer like 8 out of 10 times.
Yeah, no, I mean, listen, the big knock on GSP will always be that he fought guys that were very one-dimensional, right? He fought, you know, Dan Hardy and Fitch and Thiago Alves, even guys that were not one-dimensional. They did one thing really, really well. Kamaru Usman does a lot of things well. And, you know, I think that the debate will now rage on between these two, which is, yes, we know GSP is the better all-time fighter, but who would have won in their primes, like you said? And now the answer isn't what it has been. And I think that last night I said something to my friends that I thought was pretty bold, and I want to get your thoughts on this. So they're interviewing Usman, and it's time to call somebody out. Obviously, the Kobe Covington fight is the one the UFC wants to do. It's the obvious fight. Is there a chance that he can solidify his legacy in any other way other than I'm just going to keep cleaning out this division and keep cleaning it out because up a weight class is Adesanya. He doesn't want to do that. Down a weight – now, that's the thing. Adesanya doesn't go back up to 205, and he keeps the belt. Down a weight class, you know, they say you should never punch down. Right? You should never go down a weight class to win a belt. It's been done, but they say you shouldn't. So here's where I think it gets interesting. I told my friends last night on the microphone, he should have called out Khabib or George St. Pierre. Now, here's the deal. Him and Khabib are friends. They have the same representation. That fight's probably never going to happen, but I think that's the career definer. Or I think that GSP, if I'm GSP, I don't take a 170-pound fight, especially not against Kamaru Usman. I don't take 170. Like I would, if I was GSP, I wouldn't have fought Khabib at 170 pounds. I would have only fought him at 55. Because if you're GSP and you're coming out of retirement, you're coming out to get something you don't already have. You've already have the 170 pound belt. It's already on your mantle. So it's a long winded way of me asking: is there another path for Kamaru Usman to solidify his legacy other than cleaning out the division, letting it reset itself, and then cleaning it out again?
I'm the biggest Robert Whittaker fan, probably. Not fan, but I just appreciate everything Robert Whittaker does. Do you think Usman could beat Robert Whittaker? Because I'm starting to think he might be able to. And that's not a sentence I ever thought I'd be able to say. And maybe this is just heat of the moment, and we're just coming off this great performance by Kamaru Usman. But if Whittaker is somehow able to beat Adesanya, if they do have the rematch, or even Marvin Vettori, like, I'm going to tell you right now, if Marvin Vettori fights Kamaru Usman at 185 pounds, I would favor Kamaru Usman in that matchup. I really would. Like, odds are he's probably the favorite going into that. With Whittaker, it's different because I've seen Whittaker defend Olympic-level takedowns from Yoel Romero. And unlike the Adesanya fight with Yoel, like, Yoel tried to wrestle Robert Whittaker. The difference is that Whittaker is so good with his takedown defense. And even if you get him down, he's popping right back up to his feet almost immediately. But that matchup's starting to get compelling, too. And it's kind of like what you said. When we do ask ourselves, like, hey, who would win in their primes? I don't think Usman can fight at 155. I just think that's out of the picture, personally. He's too big for it. And unlike GSP, GSP isn't that tall. Like, he's only, what, 5'9"? Kamaru Usman's all of 6'1", and he's a big guy for the division. When I look at Usman, I really think his only ability to become champ, if that's how we're judging guys nowadays, would be going up to 185. And with him and Adesanya openly saying, like, hey, we're not going to fight each other, it is weird. Because for Usman, I think this is another thing that's going to play a part of it. He's a pretty active champion. I don't think we give Kamaru Usman the respect he deserves for being a fighter who goes out there and he fights more often than once every 8 months, once every 9 months. Like, that Gilbert Burns fight just happened. That was, what, 2 months ago? Usman is, he might not be the most active champion we've ever seen. He's not like Cowboy Cerrone or anything, but Usman's a fighter who he's not afraid to fight, you know, 2-3 times a year. So if he is able to keep that rate up, we're only really talking about 2, maybe 3 more years until he has gone through the division basically twice. So I think there are a few different ways for, Usman to kind of get that GOAT title. But at the end of the day, it's going to come down to how he's able to beat his opponents. Because I agree with you. When you look at GSP, he fought a lot of guys who were one-dimensional. And could he beat them at what they were the best at? Yeah, he could. But at the end of the day, he could always take down Dan Hardy or Carlos Condit, or he could force, you know, Josh Koscheck to become a striker. Kamaru Usman can just do the opposite of whatever you do at the end of the day. And with Usman, he can finish guys. GSP throughout his prime, he was beating a lot of guys by decision. And to you and me, I think we both just care about the W's at the end of the day. But if Usman can go in there and start finishing number one contenders, fight in and fight out, I think eventually you're just going to get to the point where it's kind of like LeBron over Michael Jordan, where it's, okay, in their primes, was LeBron as good as MJ? No, but you just look at the total body of work. Let's say Usman can defend this belt 6, 7, 8 times like GSP did, plus the long winning streak he had on his way up to the belt. I do think Usman has more than enough chance to become the GOAT at some point in his career.
Yeah, it's an interesting fight. It'll never happen, but I think that the only hope that GSP would have would be in the submission game. I think GSP would be a good enough wrestler to open up the submission game, whereas other guys, like, he's not going to out-wrestle Kamaru Usman, but he can find some openings. A couple of my takeaways from last night. Randy Brown doing the Twitch thing. I like that. I like that Joe asked him a question, and he said, if you want to hear the answer, go to my Twitch. So I was impressed with that. Masvidal, I thought, really took the loss like a stud. He said, hey, man, Kamaru's the better guy tonight. He kind of dropped all the fight-promoting bullshit and just said that. Jake Paul, Daniel Cormier getting into it. That's interesting. That's kind of has some legs for today.
Here's the thing. The only reason that Askren versus Paul was interesting was because you knew Ben Askren couldn't strike. Don't get it twisted, anyone out there. If Daniel Cormier fought Jake Paul in any kind of combat situation, he could have one hand tied behind his back for all I care, like Shane Carwin did that one time he fought Jay Ellis at like Ellis Mania. He would beat Jake Paul. Like, let's not start acting like Jake Paul can beat real MMA fighters who actually have striking in their back pocket. But it's interesting. When was the last time a fighter who's never had a UFC fight, who's had nothing to do with the UFC, is the focal point of MMA all of a sudden? Like, whether you're on the prelims, whether you're the main event, you not only know who Jake Paul is, but you're kind of interested in what he does. And I don't know if you saw the tweet he put out earlier today about like fighter pay and how, hey, Dana White, why did I make more in one fight than everyone in your company's history other than two guys? Like, he is starting to put pressure on Dana White. And it kind of gets to a certain point. You know when you don't really like somebody, but they make a great point, you're just like, damn it, they're right.
You begrudgingly,
Jake Paul's that guy. Exactly. And Jake Paul right now, I don't know what his end goal is. I don't know if he wants to fight DC. I don't know who he wants to fight next. I don't know if he wants to keep on calling out MMA guys, but he is doing the right thing and pushing the right buttons. This is what I wanted to ask you about, because he had a bit of a cameo. Did we not see Jorge Masvidal's next opponent in the crowd last night, guzzling a beer, and then he was on camera for like half a second and kind of looked? Nick Diaz versus Jorge Masvidal is the perfect return for Nick Diaz. You have the older brother defend his younger brother's honor. It's not like Masvidal's really in the title hunt anymore. He's kind of in that money fight category. I think that fight kind of made itself last night.
I think it did too. Here's the thing. And the reason why a guy like Jorge Masvidal can take a loss so easily is because he has two worlds that he can exist in. He can, much like Conor McGregor, he can exist in the championship world, which he's at or near. I mean, obviously had a championship fight last night. And he can exist in a non-championship world where he's fighting BMFs and doing, like, you know, the fights that fans want to see. He's main eventing, you know, fight nights and all that kind of shit. Here's the deal. I heard one of the Diaz brothers, can't remember which one, say this once, and it's the only thing that makes me think that, that fight would not happen. They talk in terms of that's Nick's fight and that's Nate's fight, and they honor that. So, like, Connor, for example. Connor is a Nate fight. GSP is a Nick fight. So, I think that that's...
But Masvidal was a Nick fight. That's what everyone forgets. Nick was scheduled to fight Jorge Masvidal at UFC 230, either 1 or 235. Like, the UFC had a graphic already made up for it, and it got leaked to the media. I feel like that's something that a lot of people have forgotten. Like, Masvidal was Nick's fight, and now he was Nate's fight. I feel like since there was that conversation back in the day of before Masvidal fought Till, I guess, he was supposed to fight Nick Diaz, the fact that they were paired together earlier on, I do think that that gives it a little bit of legs in the future.
So I don't want to skip the thing that we started this with because I was going to get to Nick Diaz, but we just got to him. Listen, I want to put you in the shoes of a boxing fan three, four years ago, because this is the reality that we're faced with. Okay, Jake Paul is either the biggest name in combat sports right now or one of the top three. If you were a boxing fan 4 years ago, you could see Conor McGregor coming, and you knew that, man, this guy has a big enough following to get a fight with Floyd. And as a boxing fan, you hated it because what's the upside? You know, yeah, Floyd will probably win and make boxing look better than MMA. But I'm starting to get the vibes with Jake Paul, like I'm sure boxing fans were getting the vibes with Conor. And I think Conor McGregor and Jake Paul might fight in the not too distant future. And I think that because it just makes sense money wise. If Conor loses the third fight to Poirier, listen, he's always going to have fights. Conor is always going to be somebody that people are going to want to watch fight. That's why I think he pushes he kicks the Nate can down the road so much, because I'll freely admit, 5 years from now, I would watch Conor and Nate fight the third fight. I wouldn't give a shit when it happened, but he's like, does the Justin Gaethje thing, and he sort of puts enough feelers out there. I just think Jake Paul's on that radar now, and I think that Conor could. And listen, if you think it's going to be tough for Conor to convince Dana White to go bust Jake Paul's ass, it won't be.
No,
because so Conor has what Ben Askren didn't have, which is some experience. If Jake Paul starts feeling himself, like if Jake Paul fought let me just keep it simple. If Jake Paul fought Tyron Woodley and won, even a decision, he would accept a Conor McGregor fight, 100%.
I agree with you. You just gave me a lot to consider, I guess. No, I agree with you. That was a really good comparison, too, with the McGregor and the boxing fans. And for Paul, I guess I still just don't really know how good of a boxer he is, if I'm being honest. Like, could he even beat Tyron Woodley or this version of Tyron Woodley? And this is my big problem with him fighting Conor. Jake Paul weighed in at 191 pounds in his last fight. Conor's not even close to that size-wise. Like, he would have to gain basically 20 pounds above what his walking around weight is to even qualify for a fight against Jake Paul. So the only thing that I could see maybe Dana White offering up to Paul, like, hey, you want to fight one of my guys? Israel Adesanya is pretty good at striking, and he's about your size, and that's a fight that Jake Paul just wouldn't take. Like, Adesanya, he's like, wait, you're going to let me not worry about defending takedowns, and I don't have to worry about jiu-jitsu, and all I get to do is strike with this guy? Like, there's fights out there for Paul. It's just every time we talk about Jake Paul, it's kind of like what you had mentioned with Usman punching down. He's constantly calling out guys who are smaller than him. Like, yeah. Jake never once looked at, like, okay, he's not going to call out Better Beav, the light heavyweight champion right now, but still, like, he's not calling out guys who he can look dead in the eye. He's calling out guys who he looks down at, or guys like Ben Askren, who are way past their prime. So for me, at least with McGregor, you didn't know how good he was going to be in boxing, but there was a large enough sample size of his boxing to where you had a general idea of, okay, he's got a good pull too, and he can do a few different things. With Jake Paul, I literally only know he can throw an overhand right, and he's got decent power for the size of him. But that's still the same breakdown I had after his first fight. That's the same breakdown I had after his Nate Robinson fight. And that's the same breakdown I'm going to have after his Ben Askren fight. I'm sure he's improved in the gym. And if you're dedicated to it, you're going to improve. And besides all the tactics, I do think at the end of the day, you kind of have to give him that Colby Covington respect. Where it's like, hey, if you show up every single day and you try your best, you're going to get better. And I'm sure Jake Paul tries hard when he boxes. I don't think he's getting into this just to be another guy. So I'm sure there are going to be future fights down the line where it's Paul brother versus ex MMA fighter. I just don't know if Connor's big enough. I really don't. And I do think at a certain point, it is going to be a tough look on the Paul brothers to constantly be calling out guys who they do outweigh by a solid 40, 50 pounds.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, because there's guys, right, that whose names he doesn't want to say, right? I mean, if he really wanted to get serious about fighting MMA guys that can handle themselves, Gegard Mousasi sitting right there for you. Scott Coker would gladly
let
Gegard Mousasi fight him. So here's where I think this whole thing kind of gets interesting for me, because I'm going to make a weird comparison here because we like to talk basketball. Jake Paul, and I talked to Craig about this on Early Stoppage, Jake Paul reminds me a little bit of Shaq, meaning you're trying to get Shaq to throw a jump hook when he's backing everybody down, slamming on their faces. So why would he develop a jump hook? You know, I think that Paul gets in there and he's swinging for the bleachers. I mean, he's a little bit more technical than he gets credit for, but he's not going to go in there and box with somebody. He's looking to book fights with guys who don't have great hands and knock their faces off. And I think each time there's a little bit of an increase in the thing. Like, you know, like when he defends himself in interviews, you can tell that he's setting the table for the next thing. Like he said, okay, you fought a YouTuber. Okay, now fight an athlete. He goes, well, I fought an athlete, and you give me credit. Okay, now fight a fighter. I fought a fighter. So now the complaint is fight a boxer. So the question becomes, who's the boxer? So it's going to be interesting. You know, again, I think that I would not like to see Conor McGregor. I think that at some point, people are going to have to start taking this guy seriously and going in there saying, listen, I have to go in there in shape. And I got to look to just knock this guy. I just got to fuck him up. Like, I can't keep letting him, because he's got enough power and he's not afraid to throw big. So
at a certain point, though, okay, in the next 10 years, do you think we're going to see like a Jake Paul Canelo Alvarez where it's like, hey, he's beaten six guys who are okay, and he has no chance against this real champion, but the champ's looking for an easy fight, and we can make, like, do you think they'll Tommy Morrison him at a certain point where they're like, listen, he's got no chance against these guys, but at a certain point his name's so big, and boxing, I'm not gonna say it's dead. I think people who say that, they just don't really know what they're talking about. That's too much of a blanket term. Like, there's some boxers out there who can draw, like Ryan Garcia's name's constantly in the headlines. for Paul, I do think at a certain point, a boxer is going to be like, hey, he's got a 7-0 professional record, and I'd love a big payday. And Paul might try to take that chance, because let's say on the off chance he's able to land that lucky shot on a real fighter and capture, let's say even like an IBF regional title or something, like even something like that, I think he's going to try that and take that opportunity. So do you think, let's say best case scenario for Paul, beats Tyron Woodley, and then he beats, let's say, another MMA fighter who's in their prime, though, and then he beats McGregor. Do you think there is a world where he actually calls out a real reputable boxer in a real boxing match? Or do you think this will always be that kind of freak show thing on the side?
Well, I'll just answer it this way. That Chael Sonnen has called him out as someone who studies the game. That's, he's reached out to Chael asking for advice. So he's aware of what Chael does. So if he's paying attention to Chael, here's what Chael says. You take the easiest fight for the most money. That's what you do. And so far, Jake Paul has followed that game plan. You take the easiest fight for the most money, and it's worked out for him. I think that if I were him, the move is, and I just watched an interview with him, Max Kellerman, in which he said, the problem is every boxer who's at my experience level doesn't have a name. And every MMA fighter who has a name isn't at my experience level in terms of boxing, right? So to me, the Tyron Woodley fight makes a lot of sense. I think if he fights Tommy Fury, he's going to be in for a rough night.
Yeah,
he's calling out Tommy. He's calling out Tommy Fury because of that last name, and I think that if he fights him, he's going to be good. So the poster says Fury versus Paul. That's why he's calling out Tommy, or he's even discussing Tommy Fury.
So
I think Woodley's fight.
I can personalize this really quick. There's a guy named Chris Norad. If you look it up, he's a professional boxer. He's from our city. He's from just outside. He's from like a rural area. But he had a bunch of boxing fights around here, just like regional shows. And then Huey Fury's promoter called him, and he fought Huey Fury, like Tyson Fury's cousin. Got destroyed by him. Got knocked out in the second round. But just for him to have his name, like you said, on that poster with Huey Fury, like that meant a lot to people just around here. So I could only imagine for Jake Paul having that name on there, what that could do for his brand just globally.
Yeah, I agree. All right, let's talk about who won the night. Who do you think, whose night was it? Kamaru Usman?
Kamaru Usman definitely won the night. Because that was the thing. Going after their first fight, it did, what, 1.6 million pay-per-view buys? It was over a million. Like, it was one of those big selling pay-per-views.
It was a good night.
But he didn't gain any fans because of it. Like, out of the 1.6 million buys, maybe 100,000 people after that fight were like, wow, I really appreciate his technical foot-stomping game, and I'm going to watch him in his next fight. But I don't know how many people bought this pay-per-view. All those people are Kamaru Usman fans now. Like, you can't watch his performance last night. Even if you were a Masvidal fan, you can't watch that and be like, oh, Kamaru Usman, hashtag fake newsman, Marty Snoozman. Like, he's not that guy anymore. Marty's from Nebraska. He's got them hands all of a sudden. So I think Usman, especially the way he was able to win that fight last night, he was definitely the winner.
I know you guys are doing the watch-alongs now, so I don't even know if this will resonate with you at all, but it seems like they've settled on the A-team being Anik Rogan and Cormier for, like, the bigger fights. It's going to be those three. I like them. I like the vibe. I mean, you're in the picket sign that says Joe Rogan should retire, right? You're in that camp?
I do, but I put it away last night. I didn't think he would – like, as Joe Rogan performances go, like last night was one of the better ones, I think. I thought he was really on his A game. I don't know if it was just the energy of the crowd and he seemed a lot more amped up, or if he was more prepared than he has been as of late. But honestly, and you know, like I'm not a Joe Rogan hater, but I just think that the UFC has better people in the broadcasting crew. But at the end of the day, when you just see the chemistry that not only John Anik, Daniel Cormier, and Joe Rogan have, but we do have to start throwing Megan O'Leary's name in there. Like the work that she does in between, like all that as the fighters are walking out, the information that she gives you, like she really is an important part of that broadcast too. So that four, really three-member team, I'm fine with that if that's going to be their kind of powerhouse squad moving forward. Because just think about boxing. Like boxing has a bunch of old guys who either have severe brain damage or they're just too old and don't really know the sport anymore. Like I don't really think MMA fans know how well we have it at the end of the day. And I'm even going to start throwing myself in that boat, because if I'm complaining that Daniel Cormier, not only one of the greatest and smartest fighters of all time, but like a pretty funny guy, Joe Rogan, one of the most famous people on planet Earth, and John Anik, who just kind of brings it all together. If that's what my broadcast team is, I really can't complain.
You know, I think the interesting thing here is that there was something there. I think Dominic Cruz is one of the smartest minds in MMA. The problem is he's got a little bit of a I got to be right streak, and he gets a little chippy. And I think the thing that Cormier does that's what's going to make Cormier special. And I think I think very highly of Daniel Cormier. I'm gonna say this. I've said it before. I'll say it again. I think Daniel Cormier is what could be what Michael Strahan is, which is he could host Good Morning America. He could transition out of MMA completely and go do something else. I think that what he understands is that he doesn't talk down to the audience. He doesn't talk down to Joe or John Anik. He's just he enjoys it, but he still brings the analysis. He's smart enough to get his points across without having to argue. He nudges instead of pushes on the broadcast. He's really good at what he does, and I think that him and Rogan are a good you know, Rogan is always going to keep his place, one, because of the history, but when someone gets knocked out, Joe Rogan reacting to it is a thing that you enjoy as an MMA fan. All right, let's talk about what's next. What do you guys got lined up?
Let me think. So prediction, we should be doing those tomorrow and Tuesday. I guess this show will be coming out hopefully sometime soon. Check out Early Stoppage. You can find that on this network as well with yours truly, John Franklin, and the man himself, Craig Allen of Fight Night Picks. But yeah, just getting ready for the event next week. Prochazka versus Dominic Reyes. I don't know if you know, but Dominic Reyes, a pretty good high school athlete. So yeah, just get ready for the fights next week.
You know, this is a shame that we got to get more consistent with these, because this is like my favorite show to do on the entire network. I mean, I guess kind of Early Stoppage. No, that's my shot at Craig. Ow, because on This Week in MMA, Craig said the same thing. Because this is my favorite show. Oh, wait, if John hears this, let me just clean it up and say Early Stoppage. All right, guys, there you have it. Everything that can be said about UFC 261 has been said about UFC 261. Tell your friends. Tell everybody about the Fight Night Picks recap show. We'll see you next time. Peace.